Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. You're about to see 6 minutes of video footage relating to those Jews and their tunnels, and the last video is the latest video in the matter. I have done a separate video discussing this, which I will put out, but this is one of the many topics that I discuss with Frederick and the Hillbilly Professor.
And New York City's Department of Buildings is now issuing vacate orders to a synagogue over an illegal underground tunnel in the building. Police say 9 men were arrested on criminal mischief and reckless endangerment charges for using a hole they dug in the wall to access the Brooklyn Synagogue during off hours. Brad Mielke, host of the Start Here podcast, is here with more on this. Brad, this all came about because police were responding to reports of a damaged wall and a disorderly group outside. So how did that turn into a secret passageway? And what else do you know about what this was being used for?
Yeah, this is a really wild story, Diane. And I think a lot of New Yorkers don't even know when they pass this brick synagogue in Crown Heights in Brooklyn that they're passing one of the most significant religious sites in the city. So this has stood for decades as the center of the Chabad-Lubavitcher movement, which is known worldwide, in fact, attracts worshipers from all over the world who come and pray at this synagogue and come and worship. Some people get visas to study at the yeshiva here. And so what leaders of the synagogue found out recently, apparently, was that some followers, some members, had built a secret tunnel going from other buildings into this space, which was shocking to them. They decided this wasn't okay with the leaders of the synagogue. They bring in a cement mixer to fill it all in. And that's when there's this huge confrontation. Men, as if they were protecting sort of a tree in the forest from being torn down, they actually sit in the tunnel itself to keep it from being filled in. Police are called. There's actually a huge brawl at the site. At one point, people were tearing off pieces of wood to kind of create a barricade. And eventually that results in actually a scuffle with police. Irritant gas is used, and then arrests are made. So really an unbelievable situation that actually exposed some pretty deep fissures in this pretty insular community.
So how are officials from the synagogue responding now?
Well, this actually created a pretty deep divide, or exposed a divide that's been there for years, because you have to sort of understand about this religious sect to understand why this tunnel was even being perhaps made, is that for years, this site at 770 East Park, Eastern Parkway, was led by this world-famous rabbi, known simply as the Rebbe, who created all this. He died in 1994, but until then, he had been arguing for this site to be expanded, saying we need more space. It's actually a pretty cramped space for the number of followers who are there. Well, there are some members of this sect who believe that the Rebbe's not dead. In fact, they see him as a living Messiah, and so in honor of him, there are even disputes over whether they should put a plaque up at the synagogue saying he was dead, because some people said, no, he's not. And so there were arguments over whether, you know, we should expand this site. Some people thought it was moving too slowly, and so some have speculated that some of these sort of young, more extremist men, younger guys, some of them perhaps even from Israel, decided in his honor to build this tunnel. The synagogue says it's a terrible look for the entire religion, for the entire site, and that's why they're so worried, especially considering these guys might have done more harm than good. Like you said, they're issuing that vacate order.
Now, Brad, this tunnel connects 4 neighboring buildings. So have any other buildings been impacted here? And what happens next?
Well, that's what they're trying to figure out right now. In fact, that's why the other day the Department of Buildings did say that the structural integrity of this synagogue has been affected. And so they're warning people to stay away from this site. And so that's why, again, such a deep divide in this community, because if people thought they were trying to help the late Rebbe's vision, it certainly hasn't helped, you know, the reputation or the physical stability of the site.
okay, but they shouldn't be allowed to have
screening. Not gonna help. They tried it.
We could. The problem is both sides.
They know.
A hidden tunnel was discovered under a synagogue right in the heart of Brooklyn. Hard to believe, right? Let's dig deeper into the story.
Directly to the tunnel.
Sorry, we're supposed to show an actual tunnel video. It all started when videos began circulating on social media, primarily on X, showing an altercation between Jewish Hasidic men and New York police following the discovery of a secret tunnel under the global headquarters of a Jewish movement named Chabad Lubavitch, commonly known as 770. The brawl began when the group's leaders dispatched cement trucks to seal the tunnel's opening, with no police presence inside. Proponents of the tunnel then turned violent and tore off wooden panels inside the synagogue. The police were only then called to the scene and arrested 9 people. The leaders refused to say when they found out about the tunnel, although word of their existence had been circulating around the community over the past few weeks, according to several worshippers. Those in favor of the tunnel said they were carrying out an expansion plan long envisioned by Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, a key figure in the movement. Some of the group's adherents believe that Schneerson, who died in 1994, is the Messiah and is still alive. Those who built the tunnel reportedly held this belief. They'd set out to carry out this expansion plan by connecting the synagogue to the whole empty space behind it, 21-year-old Zalmi Grossman said, adding that it was what the rabbi wants and what everybody wants. In February 2023, the founder of an initiative named Expand 770, Levi Jacobson, expressed the same desire and conviction.
The Rebbe urged that each and every Jew should participate physically and monetarily with expanding 770.
Following the brawl with the police, Mati Seligson, a spokesperson for the group, condemned the construction of the tunnel, describing it as an act of vandalism committed by a group of misguided and extremist young men. Although social media is filled with theories linking the tunnel to child trafficking, exactly why they were built and what they were used for remains a mystery.
Hi there, Frederick. How are you doing?
Greetings, good sir. Happy Saturday. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure and an honor to have you on my show for a change. And I owe you a bunch of shows. How are things over there in the mountains?
Oh, we're having a nice winter storm here on Blackjack Mountain this weekend. We've got a balmy 0 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about minus 17 Celsius, and about a 40-mile-per-hour wind and about a foot and a half of snow. So I had fun coming over to the trading post this morning across the Northeast Passage, as I call it, trudging out in the snow. I was all bundled up, you know, because this is frostbite weather, but that was nice and invigorating. I'll wake you up, you know, my good, you know, European blood that just loves the cold and can survive in the cold. So, yes, good weather here, to say the least.
Well, we whites in Africa, we're very spoiled in that sense, and we're very useless in that sense. But I can tell you that temperatures of minus 18 and so forth, the coldest temperature ever measured in South Africa was minus 20 degrees Celsius. And I can tell you there are parts that get to minus 10 in winter. And if there are blacks outside or in their places, some of those people actually die in that weather because we don't have central heating and all that kind of stuff. So I was actually telling someone else that I did a show with, I was saying about the cold, and also mentioned the earthquake in Japan. Our buildings are not in any way prepared for earthquakes. So if we had to get hit with what the Japanese went through, I can tell you probably every building in South Africa would collapse because they're all made of brick and none of them are in any way prepared for earthquakes, etc. So yeah, and it's amazing to see that blacks from Africa are heading off to you people, and they would not be able to survive in America if it wasn't for your European technology.
Right. I always tell people that, you know, this kind of weather for white people is a force multiplier because, you know, we can deal with the cold. We know how to navigate it. And it's been fascinating to watch all these diversity efforts to bring in the third world, especially from this commie carpetbagger known as Jezebel Everett, is the local caller. She's the chancellor at the state fund. This is taxpayer funded university, Appalachian State University. And when she took over, her whole thing was to bring diversity to Watauga County and New Boone, North Kakalaki. And what's fascinating is they bring all these students in the fall semester, and then they hit the winter and they all leave, you know, because they just can't take the winters. And so you just see this constant flux of, you know, turnover rates at the university because the students of color just can't handle this kind of weather. And since I've been here, the coldest we've had on Blackjack Mountain since I've been back is minus 17 Fahrenheit. And that was with 60 mile per hour winds. It was a bona fide blizzard. And that's minus 27 Celsius. So minus 17 Fahrenheit, minus 27 Celsius, 60 miles per hour wind. So you can imagine the wind chill. And, you know, that kind of weather, these people, the equatorial peoples, just they do not deal with that at all. And so this is one of the things that works in our favor up here. And so I'm like, bring on the bad weather, you know, because white people and white technology can handle it and it's going to run everybody else off. So, yeah, that's kind of what we're dealing with here. But again, every semester, though, there's all this money to, you know, philanthropy money to bring these students of color into this area. And it's all about replacing the heritage Appalachia stock. So back to you.
Yeah, very interesting. And all these equatorials and other non-whites, everyone is in America just to steal from you, loaf, and just see what can they get for free from you. That's all it is. They don't give a shit about America. They don't give a crap about any of you. But yeah.
Yeah.
Hi there, Sid.
Yeah, let me introduce myself.
Yeah, I should have got to you. My apologies. Dive in.
No, it's fine. I like hearing you guys chat. I'll just interject. Those Hasidic Jews are all on welfare. The tunnel Jews, as I call them.
The tunnel Jews.
Did you see that, Jan?
Oh, I love that tunnel stuff. One of my friends in Europe was saying, oh man, that was a good red pill. He said so many people looked at that and they were saying, like, what the hell? These Jews in tunnels? What the heck is going on here? And it goes to show a little bit of the creepy side of Jews just coming right out there in your face. I thought that was awesome. And if I may just add to that, did you notice those lazy fat Jews, okay? And did you see how worked up they got? How worked up they got over this issue of closing the tunnels? You never seen Jews get so freaking angry. And then you got to say to yourself, hey, you know, why are you so angry? What is so important about these tunnels that you lot are freaking out so much about this, about them being closed? You know, what's your little secret there? I thought the tunnel thing was awesome.
Right. When you have, you know, Jews facing off with policemen, you know, to physically try to block them from investigating what was in those tunnels, you know, that was a behavior I had never seen from, you know, the Jewish quarter. And you're absolutely right. You know, the Jews are either billionaires or they're on welfare. There is no in between. It's amazing, you know, how well these Jewish groups can milk a welfare system and a government grant system, et cetera. You know, they are masters at figuring out how to get free money. That is just fascinating. But that, you know, like you were saying, it's just a great red pill for everybody.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard of Jews being on welfare before, but I do know that in South Africa that there were Jews receiving Holocaust pensions in South Africa, that it was being paid out here in Johannesburg.
Ridiculous.
Anyway, sorry to cut you off. Please continue introducing yourself.
Yes, sorry, Sid.
Yeah, that's it. I'm a professor, and I just want to talk my motivation for doing this sort of stuff. Yeah, I've got kids, and I'm seeing things, the whites being essentially persecuted. I mean, we're the white domestic terrorists. They've been named the biggest threat to the country now, and I just don't want my kids, my progeny, being treated badly. So I'm waking up, and I'm seeing a lot of normies starting to wake up too, which is encouraging. And I think we need to start behaving more tribally and put, at the very least, pushing back across this stuff. Now, you get a couple beers in me and I might get more robust than what I recommend, but I try not to say too much online. Oh, and the one other thing I just wanted to do, and this is unsolicited, just do a quick advertisement for Jan and Frederick. It's important for whites to support these guys, because Jan's essentially one of the main players in putting the story out what's going on in South Africa, and they've got a highly sympathetic story, and Appalachia is the same way. I mean, that's one thing I think we've got a little bit of maneuvering room, because Appalachians, they're portrayed, well, and they are, and to a large extent, poor whites, and we have a lot of sympathy. And I think every normie, if he understands that you guys are down to 6% of the population in South Africa, they're like, ooh. I mean, even the most liberal, they understand that that's problematic. So I would just encourage everybody. I think Frederick works out of the RBN network, and mostly. And Jan, you can get to his website, historyreviewed.com, and contact him and support him. So that's, I wanted to say that right off the bat, unsolicited.
Thank you. Thank you kindly, Sid. I appreciate that very much.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
You know, the white right has got a hard job to do, Sid. And the people in the white right get beaten up a lot. The first thing Jews do is they try to defund everybody. You know, if Jews had their way, then anyone who speaks against them would die of starvation, because they don't want you to have a job, they don't want you to have money, they don't want you to ever earn a cent again, etc. But, you know, in favor of the white right, the good old white right everywhere has taken lots and lots of beatings, and the white right feel very bad about themselves, and they feel that they're failures. But in reality, if it wasn't for the white right, the message would never, ever get to the normies or other people. And thank goodness for the perseverance of the white right. And I myself am realizing, even in South Africa, I'm seeing more and more normal whites, let's call it normal Boers, starting to ask all kinds of weird questions. And I must say, I can't believe it. Again, today, I heard from someone else about some guy who's an advocate in the courts, and he was on a live stream, and he was talking, a white Afrikaans guy, and he was talking about, you know, the power of the Jews and how much power the Jews have. I just couldn't believe it. I'm so delighted to hear that. I can tell you the message is starting to move, and it's awesome.
Well, that's a black pill for me, because I figured South Africans figured out the story by now. I mean, we're still sitting over here with 65% of the population. So, yeah, but I'm glad to hear it. I mean, even some of Tucker Carlson's stuff has stopped me, because, and I'm hoping the WASP are over here starting to pick up on, you know, the dealio. So, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you how things really work. And if you look at South African history, and there's more stuff that I'm going to put out, is that whites in South Africa went through phases regarding the Jews. And from what I've picked up from the things that I've looked at, the Jews first came in at the time of the Boer War, because I've done a video about the role of the Rothschilds and the Jews in creating, in getting the British to invade South Africa to seize the Boer territories because of the gold and the diamonds. But then what I discovered is that the Boers have always been racist and pro-white. And so even when the British were attacking them, they didn't hate them and they didn't kill, they didn't torture them, etc. All the prisoners that they captured, they treated them well, etc. But it was when the English moved into South Africa and then more Jews came into South Africa. We're talking about 100 to 110 years ago. Then as more Jews came into South Africa, it was the English who were actually the first to put out cartoons and things talking about the Jews. And they even referred to it as the whitening of South Africa. And they were saying that the new whites are actually scum, that the new whites, the Jews, are actually scum. And it looks like the Boers took quite a while to get onto the bandwagon. And then the time when the Boers became anti-Semitic was in the time of the 1920s and 1930s, due to their contact with the Germans. That is where there were Boers who became Nazis, and they started becoming anti-Semitic. And there's actually a very interesting book written by a Boer in Afrikaans that I'm still going to translate, and it's to do with the Jews, and you'll be stunned by what he wrote 100 years ago. But anyway, the Boers became anti-Semitic and racist in the 1920s and 1930s, and that led to apartheid. So when the Afrikaans whites managed to get control of South Africa again in 1948, and they implemented apartheid, was originally anti-Semitic. It started out anti-Semitic. And then, can you believe, the first guy who was the Prime Minister, Malone, then came Israel. And when Israel came, then these Christians were saying, oh goodness, Israel's now here. And then suddenly they were invited to Israel and they were friendly to Israel. But there was quite a bit of a struggle between the Boers who were anti-Semitic versus the Boers who were pro-Israel. And the guy who was the most against the Jews and the most in favor of race was Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who was actually Dutch. And he's the guy who was assassinated in the 1960s. And then after he was assassinated, all the stuff about the Jews started disappearing. And even though there were Boers who knew that Jews were involved in some of this stuff, they never really spoke about the Jews. And then everything became like, oh, we stand with Israel and that kind of thing. So there was a lot of stuff that disappeared. And it was only small groups of whites who even knew the truth and were telling the truth. So South Africa's been sort of up and down on the issue of the Jews, and it's been hidden. You know, it's been forgotten, totally forgotten. You won't find any books that mention it, etc. In fact, there's still a video. One of my next videos to do is about something else to do with the Jews in South Africa that I think was literally totally forgotten in South Africa. People totally forgot it. And the source for it is Americans, white Americans. White Americans in the white right in America saved this information away. And I will be using that in a coming video. It tells a very fascinating story about something that happened relating to Jews and Afrikaans people. So, you know, and when the Jews were, the Jewish population of South Africa kept increasing. So as South Africa became richer, more Jews kept pouring into the country. And the Jews then took over things like, they took over and controlled all the English language newspapers, and they did all the English publications. So most English books written in South Africa were done through Jewish publishers. Most, and also lots of English literature from South Africa was written by Jews. And so when Jews are busy with that stuff, they start hiding stuff and taking things off the record and pretending things didn't happen. And Jews engaged in, let's call it, the dumbing down of white South Africa over a period of decades, just like they are dumbing you down. And they got all of you believing in liberalism. And they got you believing in liberalism, you know, despite all of your history and all of all history. But so there's like this constant battle for information with Jews. I've noticed Jews lie and get rid of truths. It's a thing they've done before. So that's all. That's the only way that I can explain it. That's what I've picked up.
Yeah, it drives me nuts because we've got like Baptist churches around here that they call themselves Zionist church. And that's some of the biggest arguments I've gotten into is with Christians and their faithful Christians. And it's like, I know people have gone over to Israel to help disabled Israeli kids. You know, they take, you know, little trips over there and drives me nuts. I'll mention the Schofield Bible, which was financed by Wall Street guys. I think Frederick could take that away from there. Go for it, Frederick.
Oh, you know, it's just fascinating that everything I learned about South Africa was wrong. And just, I think one of the biggest powers that the chicken swingers have is the power of the lie. And one of the biggest lies they tell is lying by omission. They blot the truth out. They don't allow the truth to be told. And in, you know, after 9/11, we say 9/11 changed everything. After 9/11 is when I discovered people like Karen Smith of Radio Free South Africa and Mr. Jan Lambrecht of History Reviewed. And that was when I got taken to school on what really is happening in South Africa and what has happened in South Africa since the very beginning. And, you know, it's fascinating to me the parallels between what happened in the Appalachian experiment of bringing in, you know, white European Christians that were going to tame this wilderness out of nothing, and what happened in South Africa. And then once they made it successful, you had these predators come in and say, oh, there's resource there, we're going to move in and take control of it. So you just map out when gold was discovered in North Carolina, for example, who moved in to try to, you know, corner that market, when coal was discovered in these mountains. And then, you know, 1876 is when gold was discovered in South Africa. 1900 was when the British troops moved in, and you had the Boer War in 1901. And then 1921, you had the Communist Party start up in South Africa, which was all Jewish. And, you know, 1909, of course, was the Schofield Bible Project, which basically turned, you know, Christianity on its head basically saying that, you know, the role of the Christian is to support Jews and the Israel project, that we have to return the chosen people to Israel, and they need to set up the one world government and rule over us, and we're just supposed to be good slaves to them. And you know, it's just fascinating to watch this series of events and see, wow, South Africa is basically, you know, the Appalachian experiment. It's the same thing. So back to you.
Wow, that's very interesting, Frederick. Very interesting. You know, and you're right. The Jews are liars. I did a video called The Greatest Talent of the Jews. And I used some comedy that came from a Jew, where a Jew was telling a joke. And then in a rare moment of truth, he admits, you know, we Jewish people, we know what we're good at. And what we're really good at is bullshit. And he said that, and I point out to people that everything these people do is some form of lie. And I also believe that sophistry is another part of their lying. They've got so many techniques that they use, and they know from the past that they need to hide all the crimes and things that they got up to. So they get up to all kinds of shit. And then later they see, oh, goodness, the Goyim don't like this. Ooh, we better pretend this never happened. And then they go and they hide stuff. That's why they're so paranoid, you know, because they know that you know, eventually people catch on to them and so forth. And then of course, when you tell the truth, then they're like, oh, no, it's all anti-Semitism. You've got an agenda. You are filled with hate. They have worked out that they've gone through these processes so many times. They know the drill, and they know that ultimately they need to hide everything and lie about everything. And then they say, oh, no, the stuff you're saying about us, that never happened. That's just figments of your imagination, you know. So now you've got to go and prove it again.
Yeah, my perspective is a little bit more moderate. They're tribal. And I don't blame them. I mean, they're a small percentage of the population, and they're acting in their interest. I mean, right now, the way I feel, if I knew about a white guy that pulled something, a heinous crime, I would be reluctant to bring it up, you know, and I think a lot of that plays into it. But no matter what, and that's what I'd like to see whites do, is become more tribal. And then the other thing is, I've heard Jan talk about the English, and that was horrific, the Boer Wars, you know, where they formed concentration camps, and you have to admire them, though, building all those walls around to isolate different populations. I just want pushback. I mean, I think that'd be sufficient, and we don't have that. I mean, you can't even, I mean, a lot of people just get offended, and I know this is weird, I don't even know how to articulate it, but if you say, he's a Jew, they don't, I mean, Jewish is okay, but if you just name somebody a Jew, it's like impolite or something. And they need to be pushed back against, because this, and I think there's factions of Jews that are going, you guys are going crazy. I mean, our foreign policy is unbelievable. I mean, and I was played for a fool. I was like in the Iraq War. So I'll freely admit that. I was like, yeah, let's go get them. But even with that, I was like, I don't know why we're attacking Iraq. But then you start looking into it and figuring out what's going on. And it's like we've attacked a lot of the regional competition for Israel. So they're using us as a mercenary army for all intents and purposes. And I mean, the cabinet and these neocons, I mean, they dominate the United States populace politics to a large extent, though I think that they are getting some pushback, and there's different factions that are going, you guys are crazy. And then the final thing I'd say is, I think they're slipping up. I mean, you look at the ADL, the head of the ATL, and they got that, what's his name?
Jonathan Greenblatt, Nosferatu.
Yeah, I mean, that's their spokesman. I mean, he looks like a, you know, a, I don't know. Yeah, Nosferatu. And he's offensive. So I think they're slipping, and I think they're in a panic, which is dangerous, because, I mean, they're coming down. They're doing stuff in the open now that is, it's terrible. I mean, naming the white population is threat and these wars. I mean, people are like, why the heck are we giving Israel all this money? They're a prosperous little country. And why are we supporting their wars? I mean, have you seen that map of greater Israel? That shocked me. I mean, they've got ambitions to take, I mean, to have the whole Middle East. Well, yeah. So with that, I'll shut up.
I've got some things I'd like to say. Yes, I have seen the map of Greater Israel, and Jews always think big. When I think of the Jews that I knew and all the contact that I had with Jews and other people I knew had with Jews, Jews think big, and they think big and bold in a way that the vast majority of whites don't. And yet we are the people that get most things done. I agree with you totally about pushback. If one could get just pushback alone going, where people keep pushing, where whites keep pushing back against all the things that we are told not to do, that pushback alone will take us a large part of the way. It won't solve everything, but it'll help massively, and it'll buy us a lot of time. So I do agree with the effects of pushback. And all these other more subtle things, like you say, you're not allowed to say he's a Jew. That's impolite. If you look closely at these people who are, let's call it the soft scum, who are undermining society. And in that regard, I say Jews, liberals, and communists. Because even you Americans, you've got people who are open Marxists, even whites, who are open Marxists in your society. Some of them pretend to be liberal, but between Jews, liberals, and just open Marxists in your society, you've got like this sick, weak poison that seeps into every aspect of society. And I want to tell you that when I look at the way these people have functioned, the way in which they change your culture and change your values, it's not an accident. It's not an accident. It's a thing that they've worked on for a long time. Maybe Frederick knows more. You know, what about those Germans, those quotes, German intellectuals who are actually Jews who moved to America?
Oh, great points. And you know, getting back to the Jonathan Greenblatt is the best thing that ever happened to white identity, because he is just one of those people that is just annoying. And so he's out there being the smarmy, pitiful, the eternal innocent victim, that it's like we have to just shut down everything that, you know, challenges us. And so it's really exposing the big lies of the ADL, and by extension, things like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the NAACP, and how these are weaponized NGO groups, and that these people aren't the victims, they're actually the aggressors. And, you know, when you look at the Jewish mindset of just how to change the way the goyim think, you know, like Mr. Lomberg was saying, you know, it breaks down into this idea of intransigence. And it's interesting, with the rise of Zionism in the 1800s, suddenly you had to create this new word to describe it. And so in about 1875, this word intransigence entered the English lexicon, meaning refusing to agree or compromise, uncompromising, inflexible. And this is that idea of Jewish supremacy, as we are the royalty of the planet and everyone else is here as cattle to serve us. And I break it down into what I call the Meany method, where I call it the five B's of the Meany method, where you have bully, bribe, blackmail, banish, and bury. They bully you, right? And this is that chutzpah, you know, that you know, you just, you're just arrogance, that you are, you know, you just are speaking for everyone in the room when you say this, and anyone who disagrees with you is a bad person. And, you know, after 9/11, you had about 200 Jews move into this area of North Carolina with lots of ill-gotten gain. They were highly trained Marxists. They were highly organized. They seized all the media. They seized the university. They seized the health care. They seized the education system and basically just took over with this idea of, you know, we are here to Tikkun Olam Appalachia. We're fixing the world. And anybody who dares stand up to us is a Nazi, is a white supremacist, is a racist, is an anti-Semite, et cetera. So, yeah, this is what they moved in with. And then the other thing is, you know, if you want to understand this mindset of the Jewish method, you know, study the tactics of chutzpah, basically, that, you know, you're just royalty, that, you know, you walk into the room, you are in charge, you know, your way is the only way. And, you know, Unit 269 of Israel, their special elite forces that Ehud Barak and Bibi Netanyahu are part of, their motto is who dares wins. So basically it's that idea of, you know, just be as bold and brazen as you can and you will win. Then if you have that attitude. And the other is pill pull, and you were talking about this later. It's just the mental exhaustion of trying to argue with the Jew, because they will argue whatever side they need to win. It's not about establishing objective truth. They don't believe in objective truth. What they believe in is winning. So this idea of pill pull, they will argue whatever they need to argue to win the argument of that day. The next day, they could be in an argument with somebody else and will argue the exact opposite, but they just want to win the argument. And the third is Masirah law. And what Masirah law is basically this gangland, you know, you don't talk about the gang, right? And it's, you know, you never reveal the crimes, no matter how heinous, of fellow Jews to the goyim. Right. And if you do, you are a Moser and it is allowed to kill you. We have the biblical Talmudic right to kill you if you tell the goyim what we're doing. So this is kind of like a little failsafe to keep their tribe in line, because all the Jews know that if they try to tell the truth to the goyim, that the Jews themselves will kill them. And with the Zionist method, you know, they really adopted the tactics of Judah Maccabee in the books of Maccabees, where they would kill a Jew just as quickly as they would kill a Greek if they thought the Jew wasn't being Jewish enough. So those are some of the big tactics that I try to teach people about. It's like, this is what you're up against. So, you know, definitely understand chutzpah, pill pull, and Masirah law. So back to you.
Wow, there's a lot in there that I want to just dive into immediately. Interestingly, you say their motto is, the motto of that particular unit is "Who dares wins." Well, I don't know if you know this, but the British SAS, Special Air Services, "Who dares wins" is their motto. That's their that's the motto from their military unit. I think it's them who have the motto "Who dares wins." So the Jews probably stole that.
They did. That's an excellent point. They did steal that, and their Krav Maga was also basically the martial arts that the British Special Forces had developed, that the Israeli Mossad basically stole and claimed as their own.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Yeah, the whole topic of things that Jews have stolen that belong to Europeans could probably be a topic by itself. And I'm getting a little bit diverted on this, but I'll add into this. That late friend of mine, that Boer guy, who was the professor, the lecturer in scientific method, Fani Kruger, he passed away. Fani Kruger once told me a whole story about the Jewish menorah. You know, that menorah with all those candles. He actually pointed to a tradition in Northern Europe I can't remember the exact country where it was done, where the Christians had like seven candles. And he was saying that he thinks the Jews stole the idea of the menorah from Christians in Northern Europe. But what I really want to focus on is that the key point that you make about Jews arguing to win, that it's not about the truth, it's just about winning and winning now. I cannot emphasize that enough. Frederick, that is the heart and soul of this thing when dealing with these people. Just the other day, I was talking to some other people just on a private chat, and one American said to me, Jan, how do you talk to Jews? And I said to him, the real answer is you don't bother. You don't bother because they're never gonna acknowledge anything. I knew Jews. I used to speak to Jews as much as I wanted to. I used to debate with them. My Jewish friend would even visit me in my house, and I could speak to other Jews. I saw that you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time. Just speak to other whites and focus on other whites and explain to them that Jews are not interested in facts. Jews don't care about facts. They argue to win, and they are clearly winning at a high level, and that's why everything's a nightmare.
Yeah, I would just say that I think we should emulate some of their tactics. I mean, we tribalize and like they have, and then we emulate some of the tactics, because you're right. I mean, they've been able to do amazing. I can't believe that they were able to carve out a country in the Middle East. You know, I mean, that's amazing. That's an amazing achievement. Let me just tell a quick story, the kind of stuff I've pulled. I got to look in this Hispanic category because my mom was from the Southwest. I got a little Indian blood. You know, I'm 75% Anglo, and then with a mixture of Portuguese, you know, from that area, and even some Native American. So I told my kids, you're Hispanic. And my two little girls are real fair, so they got made fun of at school. And but the boy, he's a little bit darker. You know, he's got a tan looking. And it flew. So he was able to get scholarships and stuff based on that. And I'll tell you another little funny anecdote. My daughter, because, you know, all my kids are real credulous, and they don't know, you know, I don't push any racial politics on them to a great extent. But she's got a little black friend, actually, it's probably her best friend. So she's doing college interviews. She's got a college interview with MIT, by the way. To have this little black friend of hers pop in, you know, like it's an accident in her FaceTime interviews with the colleges, you know, just because if you put, yeah, my best friend's black, it sounds contrived, but if she just shows up and then you know, run her off, it looks authentic, which, I mean, that's crafty and, I mean, sort of dishonest, but I'm like, yeah, no, I mean, we need to, and I've heard Jan talk about it, that the South Africans have learned how to work around the blacks and stuff, and you got to work within the system that you find yourself in. So, yeah, I mean, you know, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, I'd been like, yeah, you don't want to do stuff like that, and it's like, well, hell, the gloves are off as far as I'm concerned. I mean, when they declare us public enemy number one, it's like, yeah, we got to start getting crafty, and it's time to start winning again. So, yeah.
Now you're talking. Look, I've even recently had Rhodesians say to me, you know, we should have fought to win, and that's the way I see it as well. Is that life is a war, and nature is ruthless, and you're stuck in the system. You're stuck in. Learn to work around it, because we need to create the system that we want. And in the case of you guys, you need to get back to where you were. So, but also Jews come in. You know, the other thing about Jews is Jews have got a hell of a lot of experience of moving around the world. And because they've been kicked out of so many places, they've also traveled a lot and been among different whites. And they've tried the same thing again and again. They've perfected the art of what you could call Jewish colonization. And I actually did a video about it very long ago, a little quick video where I said, you know, whites colonize blacks and Jews colonize whites. And that to me is still very valid. And the colonization that to me is the most horrific one that the Jews pulled off was the colonization of the Spanish. And believe it or not, I've not even done a full video about that. But, you know, they came in, they paid the Muslims to conquer the Spanish, and the Muslims were the armed force, and Jews and Muslims controlled these Christians for 700 years. And it was a real struggle for these white Christians to get free of Jews. It took them hundreds of years. And I, when I look at what the Jews are doing in the West, they're trying to move in, and I think they're trying to do the same thing. And if people are weak and people let it get past a certain point, then whites could be turned into dumb liberals, and you remain a dumb, stupid liberal for like the next 300 years. And there are facts, like racial facts, that people will forget. And to me, that is horrific. I find that horrific.
Yeah, just look at Henry Ford and Disney, how they're pilloried. I bet they're both spinning in their graves now. Well, especially Disney, given that I like to refer to them as the Jewish Mafia, because I did a deep dive on Epstein. And it's clear, so during World War II, our intelligence services sort of teamed up with the mafia because they were in Italy and controlled the docks and they wanted intelligence from them. And they've essentially merged. Well, I think what happened is the Jewish mafia largely sidelined the Italian mafia. But we definitely have a Jewish mafia that assassinates people, compromise them with blackmail. So I like to refer to that. I'm an optics cuck, I'll admit that, because I'm thinking, well, if a normie happens to chance upon this little podcast, you don't want to give it to him, make him swallow the whole cow. But the other thing I would say is, and I've listened to Jan, and the Boers have a lot of grievances against the English, and we're fractionalized and stuff. But I don't think we can afford those kind. I mean, as far as I was talking to a guy, and he's setting up a thing in Exarchia, and he says he wants only Anglo Saxons or Aryans down there. And I was telling him, I think white is sufficient. I mean, we can't afford these brother differences. I mean, Slavic, Italian, they're whites. And then finally I'll end up with this is by some definitions or philosophies, all three of us on this call are insane because we're insane because we're swimming against the current of our respective, well, less so for Iran because South Africa, but the currents of our societies. And we're all cranky crackpots is what, not really, but what I'm saying. And you got to moderate those impulses because we got to start working together. And I have to moderate them on myself because I've got a quick temper and stuff. And so, you know, that's my plug for, you know, white unity.
Oh, great point. Especially liked the comment of how the Jewish mafia overtook the white European mafias. And key point that, you know, nobody talks about in history was September 11th, 1931. One of the things I've learned is September 11th, 9/11 is one of their mystical Kabbalistic numbers, right? And so on September 11th, 1931, there was a nationwide purge in the United States where over 30 old mafia bosses that were, you know, they refer to them as the Mustache Petes, the traitor Lucky Luciano was working with the Jewish mob that would become Murder Incorporated under Meyer Lansky, and they took out over 30 bosses on the same day. And they basically just, you know, this is how organized they were. And the other thing is the diaspora that, you know, you had after, you know, the 70 AD, you know, Jerusalem is conquered, 135, Jerusalem is destroyed and renamed, and that was the beginning of the diaspora. And one of, you know, credit where credit's due, one of the evil geniuses parts of Rothschild and Jacob Frank when they were starting the Illuminati was Rothschild sent each of his sons to a different European city. And when you look at, you know, how he did that, I always refer to in game theory as slime mold, where they just kind of come in, you know, nobody notices them come in, and they start seizing power with, you know, the 5B method, like I was talking about. And, you know, Rothschild, you know, had the, you know, the money creation, making money out of nothing and loaning at this incredible interest rates. And so I'm trying to bring up the actual, Meyer Amschel was in Frankfurt, Germany. Solomon Rothschild went to Vienna, Austria. Nathan, London, England. Kalman Meyer was in Naples, Italy, and Jacob Meyer was in Paris, France. And what happened in World War One? You basically had this European capitals fighting each other, right? Who was behind it? And so in the game theory model, it's let's you and them fight. So where you have a triune game theory where you've got an instigator that's setting two enemies at each other's throats to destroy each other. And this was the brilliance of, you know, taking the diaspora, saying we don't have a land, we're going to infiltrate all of these Gentile capitals, make them destroy each other, and at the same time start carving out our claim to Israel, right? And so you can just see that, you know, with the Balfour Declaration of World War One, World War Two, all this that has been declassified, that this was the Jewish century. Every war was just these chessboard moves to create greater Israel. Theodore Herzl's dream of greater Israel. And you had the Ottoman Empire be destroyed by World War One. You had the British move in under the Palestine Mandate. And then the Jews moved in and ran the British out. And you had the birth of Israel. Now with 1980s, you had the Odin-Yenin plan, where they're going to Balkanize all the Arab countries, set them at war, and have the Americans and the British go in and kill all the Arabs, Balkanize those nations, leaving greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates as the sole superpower of that region. And, you know, so right now we're seeing the Gaza genocide because that's just another part of this plan. Bibi Netanyahu, you know, he's just trying to continue Theodore Herzl's vision. You know, once, you know, Gaza's gone and the West Bank's gone, then they're going to start moving into Egypt. They're going to start moving into Syria. They're going to move into Lebanon because, you know, their goal is to establish greater Israel. So back to you.
Very interesting. I want to just mention a few other things that was discussed. The whole issue about groups and the fact that we are going against the group mold. If you look into the way groups behave, there is a quote along the lines that insanity among individuals is rare, but insanity in groups is common. It's common. The group can sway from one side to the other. And Jews know how to play humans as herds of animals. About white unity, I totally agree with you. And Ben Clarkson is the guy who's done the most work on this. I really like Ben Clarkson of the Church of Creativity. He's, to me, he's been the greatest racial thinker, greatest racial Nazi thinker since Hitler. And Ben Clarkson said that all whites should stick together. In other words, if you're of European descent, you stick together. And you don't worry about other little things like Slavs or Portuguese or this or that. In fact, if you actually look at the map of Europe, you'll see that as whites have spread out of Europe, as parts of Europe have expanded, that whites do end up having a little bit of interracial action with people that they are bordering on. You can see this especially like with the Russians, with the whites in the eastern part of Europe heading off to Russia. You'll see that there's interbreeding with Mongols, etc. So, you know, there is a bit of interbreeding everywhere, and there was even interbreeding here in South Africa originally because there weren't white women here and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that is kind of normal on the edges of civilization. But as a whole, if whites as a group stick together, where the majority of the DNA is white and we stick together, that's fine, because that doesn't violate any of the laws of DNA. You know, because at the end of the day, humans are no different to cattle and deer and any other animal. And, you know, a farmer can take a herd of poor cattle, and by just bringing in the correct bull and all that kind of stuff, he can over time improve the quality of his entire herd. That's what farming is all about. So I don't see a little bit of DNA problems, minor DNA issues, as like a big thing. Even Hitler and the Nazis looked at people who were one quarter Jewish. If you were three quarters European / Aryan and one quarter Jew, you're an Aryan, period. You know, it's and that's how they dealt with the thing. So I think people who nitpick too much on DNA, oh, I only want Anglos, I only want this, I only want that, I think that's taken it too far. And I really do think that ultimately, if whites can really get down to a proper racial state and so forth, that's when you bring in the scientists and so forth, and you actually do some real studies about what exactly can you do to improve the whites that are not quite that good. I really don't see it as a big issue. And I don't think people need to nitpick on this brother issue, like you say, with the Slavs, etc. Totally agree with you. And I do want to ask you guys, before I forget, tell me about the collapse of the National Justice Party as well.
Yeah, I've looked into it a little bit, and I don't know, it's just pitiful. It's a black deal. I have actually defended them online, but essentially what it was is they had a podcast, and they're you know, doing humorous comedy, racial comedy, and yeah, you were even on there. I loved your interview on TRS, by the way. And then they formed this party, and my thing was, well, you know, if nothing else, it's safe to protect serious guys, but they're essentially a bunch of clowns, and it just collapsed all at once, and sort of grifters, though I don't, you know, they were just doing their little comedy show. But there's been, stuff coming out where they're talking. I mean, they're just, they're not serious guys. I mean, so they're smart. I mean, that Mike Enoch's a smart guy, and they're not stupid. But yeah, I don't think that they're a serious outfit at all. But my point was, is if they could even get big enough to cut into the Republican election issues, they could pull the so-called Overton window more to us. If the Republicans start losing elections because 10% of the whites would just refuse to vote for them, they could have an impact. Let me mention one other thing. When we had our call-in show, me and Frederick, this guy called in from the Libertarian Party, and he goes, "Yeah, you can." They're on the ballot in a lot of states. The majority, and you can go in there and take over a Libertarian Party. The slate's wide open, and you can change the name of the party. So, you know, for instance, you care. Change it to Heritage Appalachian Party, or focus on local offices like sheriffs. Over here, sheriffs have tremendous power. I mean, they've got a so-called Constitutional Sheriff Association, but they can stand off the federales. They can tell the ATF, this is unconstitutional, get the hell out of my county. And one could deputize, because they shut down the militia unit here in the 80s. I mean, they shut that down. But a sheriff could deputize 100, 150 reliable men, and you'd essentially have a militia. So I think there's different possibilities there. But yeah, it was just pitiful. I mean, it makes me sad to even contemplate the NJP.
Yeah, that was one of the black pills around Charlottesville. That was so synthetic and astroturfed, and you had groups like, you know, the National Justice Party come out of that. And I think one of the problems was the purity spirals that, you know, everybody, instead of attacking the enemy, they're attacking each other as to who is more pure, who is more right, who is the smartest guy in the room type of thing. And they were also, you know, targeted by like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the NAACP as a convenient whipping dog that, all those white supremacists over in the NJP, they are a threat to our democracy. And so this was the typical Marxist thing, is you just call somebody a Nazi, call somebody, you know, this, that, and the other. And it's a good way to demonize them in front of the general population. And this is, you know, playing into what you were talking about early with group conformity. And one of the things I always tell people is go back to the 1950s and 1960s and look at all of those, you know, psychologists that were doing all of that research, and realize that these were all Jews that were basically doing psychological research on goyim, especially white goyim, right? They were all college students. So it's like, how can we manipulate the best and the brightest of these white American goyim? And so when you look at the group conformity experiments of Solomon Asch, he was able to manipulate up to 74% of the general population if they were only exposed to the big lie. And his tactic was, you had the person up front lying, and then you had confederates or shills in the group that the test subject thought this was just another person in the group, but they were actually another liar. So you had a peer liar and a leader liar. And if there's nobody in that group speaking the truth, up to 74% of the people would conform to the group just to go along, to get along. But what they found in follow-up studies was that if you had a person speaking the truth, that number would go from 74% down to less than 5%. So truth was very powerful. And this is why you have all these groups like the ADL trying to shut down truth on the internet, because it goes against their big lie theory. The second is the Stanley Milgram authority experiments, where you had, you know, people would bow to authority up to 50% if they're being bullied, right? Then the Stanford prison experiments with Philip Zimbardo, where, you know, you basically can get groups to turn on themselves. So if you have a corrupt prison warden telling the prison guards that these people are evil, they're bad, they don't deserve human rights, they're no longer prisoners of war, they're enemy combatants, right? That kind of thing. You can get them to become very sadistic and do horrible things. Then Martin Seligman learned helplessness. How do you make people just finally give up and not even try anymore? And then the last one is Jane Elliott's experiments on school children. It was known as the blue-eyed, brown-eyed, where basically you say, oh, blue-eyed people are bad, brown-eyed people are good, and you could actually get children to turn on each other within the group by just dividing them, and this is that lets you and them fight. And an excellent point by Sid about the sheriff. In the United States, the sheriff race is probably the most important election you can vote in. Whoever is the president of the United States, that's not really going to affect you on a day-to-day basis. But your local sheriff, if you have a corrupt sheriff, that is bad. But if you've got a good sheriff, that is a huge force multiplier. And also your county coroner medical examiners. To me, those are the two most important political races in U.S. politics, is your local sheriff and your local medical examiners, because if they will stand up to these feds that move in when the FBI comes in and say, we're taking over, it's like, no, you have no jurisdiction here. We're going to do a real investigation versus this corrupt FBI, Department of Justice, Homeland Security, which is the new thing after 9/11, where they come in and they try to bully and take over so they can, you know, corrupt the investigation to make it go their way versus trying to establish the truth. So those are just some things to think about. So back to you.
There's some fantastic stuff there that you mentioned. I love these psychological experiments because, you know, when I look at Jews, they focus on advertising, closing the deals, etc. And it's amazing the levels they go to work with people's minds. That to me is the core of all Jewish success, is they focus on the human mind. Whereas whites focus on reality. We focus on, go out, how do I build a house? How do I get food? You know, how do I travel, etc. We focus on conquering nature and subduing nature for our purposes. And that's our strength. But Jews don't do that. Jews aren't interested in, you know, how do I go and hunt a deer? What Jews are interested in is, you know, can I sell this guy some property? What money can I lend him? How do I close this deal? That is where I see them being a very specialized group. And that is why they function like an apartheid state that enters every country. And when they enter any country, they come with the same tribal game. You know, oh, we're the special religion. And you know what? That stuff that you do there, no, we don't do that. And we have holidays when we want this. And we're different from you in that way. And you'll see that they are like a bird making a nest. And the bird is there and it's making its nest. And it's going to live in your territory. You know, I look at them in that way. But I just want to get back to the NJP quickly. And I think somebody's forgotten to put off their mute. But the NJP, from what I understood, you know, I was on the TRS show once. And it was good fun. And it was actually one of my supporters in South Africa who actually came up with the idea of me going on to TRS's show. And I went on to the show and the show was great fun. And I saw how they did it, and it was very fun and very interesting. And there was one of the guys I kind of kept in touch with a bit. But the big thing that I wondered was, how serious are they? It's like the Daily Stormer. You know, if you're joking and laughing all the time, my question is, how serious are you? Because actually, life in the white right is pretty nasty, and things are going to get ugly. Well, when the Jews came after me, to toss me in court, and they were trying to do all kinds of things, including trying to jail me. After that, when that stuff was on, I went back to TRS and I sent them emails and I said to them, listen, I'm in court and these things are happening and the Jews are coming after me, etc. You know, this might be something good for a show. And you know what? I never heard from TRS ever. They never responded. They were never interested. So that made me conclude that this TRS crowd, they're not a serious crowd at all. And so when I heard that they were doing the NJP, there was another American that I met when I was in America in 2019. He's very active all over the white right, and he moves around a lot, and he's in with all kinds of people. And he was telling me, oh, the NJP, this is it. You know, we have liftoff. And I was kind of wondering, I was sitting and wondering, well, okay, if you say that this is the real thing, that's fine. In recent times, when I discussed the NJP collapse, there were other people who sent me links to a very interesting website. I think the website is called Majority Rights. And there were a bunch of articles on majority rights, which I published on my website, where there were people who years ago had pointed out that, you know, Mike Enoch might be a Russian Jew. And there is even some audio where Enoch actually talks and admits, you know, he's Jewish, and he also married a Jewish woman. So, you know, the thing for me is that either you're serious and you're going to walk the walk and you're going to hang in there, and if you're just into light entertainment and stuff like that. And to me, these guys seemed more businesslike, and they're just interested in making some money. And I don't think that they're there for the heavy stuff. So I kind of have a skeptical view of those guys.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to this issue of psychiatry, which essentially the Jews invented, and come at it from a biological angle. And I'll be brief, but I'll just tell a quick little story. And I don't think my views are any more controversial than smart parents tend to have smart children. A lot of it's genetics. But I followed a sophisticated biomedical blog, and it gave advice on grant writing, talking about, you know, stuff that's going on in medicine and biology. And just a full disclosure, I'm more of a biochemist physiologist. I'm not a geneticist. But anyways, they'd come up with Crick, Francis Crick, the guy, you know, him and was it? No, it was Watson. I'm sorry. The guys that discovered the structure of DNA or deduced it. I mean, these guys, they won the Nobel Prize. Somebody toasted him at a meeting, and he's a 90-year-old guy. So they toasted him, and they jumped down this guy's throat because he had toasted this guy because he'd said racial stuff. He said something along the lines of, hey, you can plow all the money you want into Africa, but it ain't going to do much because they just don't have the wherewithal or the IQ to accomplish. I mean, you can't turn it into Europe, no matter how much money you give them. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And he'd said something along that because he's a realist and he's a geneticist. And so he's persona non grata, but here they are, you know, getting angry on this blog. Because he was toasted, somebody had the tenacity to actually toast this racist. And so we got into a big fight, and I was the main instigator of it. I'm saying, well, there is genetic differences. I went through the race realism points. Well, even among scientists, it's taboo to talk about genetic differences in intelligence. It's just nonsense. Like I said, it's smart people tend to have smart kids. You can have an outlier here, you know, on the high end or low end type of deal. But it's a taboo to discuss what's going on with genetics and how it relates to intelligence. And it's just utter nonsense because, you know, genes control brain size. They control, you know, my smartest kid, just by, for example, he had a soft spot until he was like a year and a half old or something. So, I mean, it's, you know, a bunch of genes that are controlling intelligence. And but it's taboo to even look into here because the what society's telling us is, oh, well, race is just skin deep. Bullshit. And I'll tell you another thing, one thing I brought up in the comments section, and I'll try to post that in our little channel. We got an Appalachian Hill Tribe Telegram, by the way. If there's any Appalachians listening, you might consider joining up. We discuss stuff of interest to Appalachia. But the Chinese are moving hard into the area. And Jews, you know, there was a guy in the chat, and I know for sure he was a Jew. But he was a race realist. The Jews are, by and large, race realists. I mean, it's all DNA with them. But he was arguing that, you know, the genetics control a lot of this. But anyways, my point was is the Chinese are moving into this area hard. They're trying to identify the genes. They've made a $1 billion investment in identifying the genes that control intelligence. And it'll be possible to use viruses to insert genes that into embryos, into cells that could enhance the intelligence of, you know, the baby that's eventually born. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's compelling. I mean, right now the technology is you could do in vitro fertilization. What they usually do with in vitro fertilization is they fertilize several eggs. And then they, you know, because you want to have extra, and then they implant them. And then if one takes, then, you know, that's all the better. So what they could do is fertilize whatever it is, 20 eggs, and then test the eggs to see if they have, you know, a lot of the genes that confer intelligence, and then select the top three. So that's doable right now. Now, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, like I said, I'm not a geneticist, where they're actually they're able to jack in genes. You know, you take the embryo or whatever and infect it with a virus that would insert the genes into the genome. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's coming down the pike. And I would say the Jewish – a lot of the Jewish scientists are I mean, they experienced it because, you know, you mentioned the Rothschilds earlier, and they took – tried to breed within the fairy circle. My dad raised dogs, so we were, you know, breeding dogs and stuff. And what happened is you get too inbred, and, you know, you start getting diseases and neuroticisms just popping up. And I think they've realized this because if you'll notice, they're trying to outbreed with the best whites. I mean, Trump's kids are all married to Jews for the most part. Clinton's kids. And so they've made adjustments to their, you know, the way they're behaving. They're not trying to marry within the fairy circle as much anymore. And I'm a big proponent of outbreeding. My wife's Romanian. And so we share a lot of genetics, but not like it's happened in Appalachia, too. These small communities, you get inbred communities. And I've talked to teachers and people professors that have worked up with some of these small communities, and they'll say the bell curve is weird. He said you'll get like camel hops where you got a part of the population that's below the average, and then another big part that's above the average. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's coming down the pike on that. So, yeah, sorry I rambled on.
No, it was excellent. I found it extremely interesting. And, you know, the science stuff is of tremendous interest. And I wish that whites and Western nations would do more of this stuff. How is it that scientists are not allowed to talk about things that are basically scientific?
Well, I mean, you start discussing that. I mean, yeah, I'm on there saying, well, you know, there's differences in the races, an average IQ, and it's all underpinned by genetics. That goes against the general trend. That's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a blind spot there, but there was arguments because there was knowledgeable geneticists and people that are actually, they do intelligence research, but it's taboo. I mean, that would be my major point there is even among the scientists, race is skin deep and that's the religion and you don't want to go against it. So you saw the COVID stuff. I mean, I sat there in shock That's how we really started communicating, because you had written me an email and we'd discussed stuff before. And you're like, they're trying to tell me this COVID vaccine is, and I'm sort of proud of this, this COVID vaccine is going to kill everybody. And you were asking my advice because you knew I was, an academician. And what I did was send you the mortality data. And essentially with COVID, if you were under 50 years old, the statistical mortality rate was zero. Unless you were, fat, diabetic or something like that. Over 80, it went up to like 15%. But that's what flu does. Influenza kills a lot of 80-year-olds. And I'm like, I've taught drug discovery courses, and I know it takes them about seven. If you come up with a new therapeutic, it takes them about 7-8 years on average to get it through the regulatory process. You got to do the clinical testing to make sure it doesn't have any. I mean, you start putting something into a biological system, it could have bad effects. Everything through in a year. So my point was it's not the mortality rate's not that high or zero for young people. Don't give it to kids, this essentially experimental vaccine, because there could be unforeseen side effects. I mean, and I even told you I don't see anything particularly dangerous about it, but it's a little bit risky, and there has been some myocarditis and stuff. I don't think it was I don't think it was a bioweapon or big plan, but it's like people are delusional. Even so you can't trust the scientists necessarily because they buy into a lot of stuff. But I think I called that right, so I'm a little proud of that. But
I appreciated your feedback on that, because I was quite concerned myself, because so many people in the white right and that mRNA stuff, which I didn't quite understand, but it did appear to me like, maybe this thing could be a bigger thing. So when you replied in that way, I was very grateful for that. And I did mention that to people, and you've been proven correct. And so very, very fascinating. There was something else I wanted to mention. The thing that you are saying is that scientists are also, that modern intelligent scientists are even afraid to deal with the raw scientific truths. And I think a question that needs to be answered is, how did it get to be that way? Is there money? Is there money and funding and stuff that is causing those scientists to not say to go down another path? Because there has to be a mechanism. I find it hard to believe that it's just an accident, because these things were firmly established already. I think the IQ issue was already established in the late 1800s. Correct me if I'm wrong, because Hitler was already talking about certain things. When people were looking into heredity? Heredity may not have been like a scientifically proven thing all the time, but for long periods of time, whites have known that there is some kind of heredity going on, whether it's with humans or with animals or with plants, because it's not like it's a mystery. If you get two cows that are white, the cows aren't suddenly going to have a calf that is dark brown, that kind of thing. I speak as a farm boy, not a professor.
Well, I was a farm boy too. I'll tell you, there's a couple things. The ancients knew it. I mean, we've been breeding animals, and we put a good horse out the stud. It's like Man of War, and who was the other big one? He had a mutation that made his heart twice as big as the normal horse, and he could run forever and fast. So he Secretariat, that's the one. So they put him out. Of course, they put him out the stud with the idea that they hope the genetic essentially a mutation would show up in his progeny, which it did. I think maybe Man of War was derived from him. But I'll tell you another story, and this will probably shock you. So my dad's sort of a hillbilly, and we'd go out hunting, and we had these dogs. And if one of – so a problem with is rabbit hunting, a problem with dogs, some dogs like to chase deer. Well, at that point, they're worthless as a hunting dog because they're not focused on rabbits. And a good good beagle, that's always interested is rabbits. It's amazing. I mean, how could you breed that into them? Well, I'll tell you how. He'd routinely shoot a dog if it chased deer. So there's a lot of calling. And that sounds my own. A lot of people be like, oh, my goodness gracious, who is this guy? But if you think about it, that's how we got a lot of the dog breeds. A dog bites a kid. Boom, you put it down. It behaves in a certain way that you don't like. So culling is just, I mean, a lot of these guys weren't sitting there, okay, let's take this dog, and although there is some of that, it has good characteristics, let's breed it with this dog. And along those same lines, I'll tell you this, brothers and sisters, among the dogs, right? And man, by the time he got down three or four generations, we had some crazy dogs. I mean, we had one that was named, he always named them the same. So all the girl dogs were named Daisy. All the male dogs were named Butcher. We had one that was like Crazy Daisy. And this was the most neurotic dog I ever seen. Real mean, too. And she would belly crawl up the ditch. And she hated this dog next door. She'd belly crawl up the ditch and sneak up on this other dog and just jump and attack it. So you get into those kind of things when you get too much inbreeding. And I think the Jews are reaching that point, and they're making an effort to outbreed a lot more. So I know that's a digression, but it's important. So, yeah, the ancients understood a lot of this stuff.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And I don't have a problem with things being shot. I speak as a farm boy. I also shot some things that I shouldn't have shot. But you know, that's reality, and people need to get adjusted to reality. And I think farming people and rural people are much closer to raw nature. And I must tell you that when I look at the helplessness of people in cities, even in Africa, it's disgusting. But that's a whole other topic. So very interesting about the dogs. You know, just shoot the dogs that are a problem. Well, that shows you that execution does have certain values, and you know, you could get into the issue of culling humans, but very, very fascinating that.
Well, I would be more humane with it, but and I tell people I'm sort of a eugenicist, and they're shocked, and the white right. But I mean, you know, why not offer, and you wouldn't even have to make it racial, just say, if you want to get a vasectomy, we'll give you, set up a foundation, we'll give you $1,500. And that would select for people that probably should have a vasectomy. You know, if you'd sell your fertility for $1,500, you know, stuff like that. And that's totally humane. It's up to them. And I've said, too, that I favor reparations. Offer them $150,000. They have to give up their citizenship and move. You know, cut a deal with Nigeria. Nigeria take newly rich American Africans. Cut a deal with Nigeria to accept them and give them citizenship. They have to give up their American citizenship. Stuff like that. I mean, I don't know. Do I sound crazy? Maybe. I don't know.
No. You know what? There are too many things. We're entering a soft, pathetic world, and softness will kill us. I much prefer, we've got to stick with reality, and reality is much harder, and we've always actually been a much more logical and realistic people. I think that even this softness and morality and caring for all kinds of human garbage, I am sure that this is also some kind of Jew nonsense, you know, because I mean, look at like that Jewish hag who put that thing on the Statue of Liberty. Oh, give us your poor, give us your poor. You know, so what's that? More than 100 years ago or whenever, the Jews were already asking for the garbage of the world to come to America. I'm sure that normal white Americans didn't want that. That's why you were bringing in Western Europeans and Northern Europeans.
Yeah, I can jump in here. Yeah, that's the fascinating thing about the Kalergi plan is you're going to have basically a two-tiered system as your outcome, a royalty of purebred Jews, and then a mongrel race of brown people of low IQ. And so this idea of race realism is one of the things that has been purged from American science. You know, up until the 1930s, people understood this. And like you said, it's farming. You know, this, you know, we've been domesticating animals since 5000 BC. And one of the things you learn as a farm boy, I grew up on a farm. We had beef cattle and also raised chickens, as well as, you know, crops, et cetera. But, you know, nature is ruthless. And one of the things you learn is you have to get a new sire, because if you have a, you know, sire mating with its offspring, then you get all of the bad effects. And so it's interesting when you look at the old fertility cult religions around 5000 BC to 0 AD, especially Ishtar, and the idea of the sun king and the fisher king, the idea of the champion who is sacrificed at the winter solstice, right? And because they knew this, that you would be king for a year and you would be the sire of all the maidens, but then you would be ritually sacrificed. This was, you know, part of the religion. And so it was when I was a child, you know, I was always interested. We always had to get a new bull, you know, regularly. It would go into the freezer because, you know, we were, my parents raised some beautiful cattle, but that's part of it. And, you know, the idea of grading, sorting, and culling is part of that. And race realism is part of that. And one of the biggest lies I think we got as Americans was this kumbaya, everybody's the same, everybody's equal. And they, you know, pump that into our heads that, you know, the only differences in people is the cosmetic. You know, you may look different hair color, different skin colors, but everybody's the same. The bell curves are the same. The temperament's the same. Your understanding of the universe is the same, and nothing could have been further from the truth. And they knew this. This one of the things that's in the protocols that they said they were going to teach the Goyim youth things that they knew were lies. And equality of the races is one of the big ones, because they wanted this misogynistic, degrading of the white race. They want Amalek blotted out, and the way to do that is to crossbreed with inferior races. And so, you know, it's been fascinating to me after my, you know, waking up that that was all bull, because I was one of those insufferable libtards that believed in equality and, you know, the racism was bad, etc. And it's like, no, you have different IQ curves, you have different EQ, emotional quotient, you know, where are the trigger points with different races, and also TQ, temporal quotient, your idea of conceptualizing time, you know, be it short-term time, minutes, hours, days, years, etc. And you realize these people, especially equatorial people, they do not have a concept of time like Europeans do. They do not have the same emotional levels that Europeans do, and they do not have the same intellectual quotient as Europeans do. And the Jews knew this, and that's what they're trying to get rid of. You know, so it's definitely that, you know, race realism that we have to come to grips with. And we're going up against a big propaganda machine that, you know, wants this equality, because they, you know, it's basically, you know, the transhumanism movement isn't about making humans better. It's about making the Goyim mongrels, and that can be easily controlled and won't push back when they start culling large numbers of us. Because we always remember, their holy books say that they need to cull down the population to about 500 million. And so that's a big culling of the global population. So back to you.
Is that in the Talmud? Would they say 500,000? Do they actually
that know? Technically is in, I think, the Zohar. Those magic numbers come out of the Zohar and the Kabbalah, and then the rabbis in the Talmud will discuss it. But I think the actual sources come out of the Zohar on that.
Well, guys, it's been a very awesome chat. this must be the highest IQ chat I've been in yet. So it's very, very awesome. And just about the Jews, Hitler said that the Jews can only rule over a mongrel nation. They can't rule over whites. You know, they need lower IQ people. So yet again, Hitler way ahead of his time. And I think that when I look at Jews and all their determination to destroy the concepts of race, that it all boils down to they've seen that they got a big fright from the Nazis. They've seen what whites really can do, and it gives them the creeps. I think the only people that really scare Jews are Nazis. And the good news is Hitler will scare them until the end of their existence. But if each of you would like to say some final things, and then we wind up for today. But I thought it was very valuable chat, and you guys are very knowledgeable. Frederick, your stuff is tip top. And I really enjoyed that science stuff that you were giving us, Sid. I really value that stuff. Okay, guys.
Go ahead, Frederick.
Oh, well, I'll jump in then. Thank you so much for having me. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. What a great way to spend a Saturday morning snowed in. And I love the internet that we're able to do this. It's still fascinating to me that we can talk in real time halfway around the world like this. And so both of you, I think your work is fantastic. I enjoy working with both of you. And, plug my show for people that are interested. My show's on Saturday nights on RBN and Spreaker. It's called Blackbird 9 Saturday Snack Shack. It's from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern. And you can follow me on Twitter and Gab and everything. It's Blackbird 9. So just do a search on Blackbird 9 and you'll find me. And again, thank you so much. It has been, I just love discussing these things with people that are so sharp as the two of you. So back to you.
Yeah, I'm tapped out. I'm starting to slur my words. But I just say it's tell you how much I've enjoyed. I went to an American Renaissance conference, and it was so nice because you're talking to people that think like you, and it's very rare that I get an occasion to talk to people that are the things that I believe. So I really enjoy it. I get a kick out of these. So, yeah, with that, I'll end.
Well, guys, thank you very much. And yes, regarding things like American Renaissance, etc., isn't it wonderful when we get together and we can talk about common issues? I really believe that a lot of stuff is possible if we all just stick together. And notice how the Jews don't want us to talk to each other about all these other things. So that should show you that there's a real issue there. And thanks very much. It has been awesome chatting to you guys. We'll definitely be back talking again.
If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you will. Every fight you fight.
afraid.